Well, I'm not sure there's much harder a task than attempting to preach on a really familiar passage. It's got to be one of the most kind of toughest jobs that you can be given as a preacher. At least if you have a difficult or an unfamiliar passage, it may really take time to dig in into things. But as you learn, as you prepare, basically, and then I find I have a really lovely job of basically sharing some of the things that I had excitement in finding all those things out. With something very familiar, you not only have the pressure to say something different to the other 4,000 sermons that someone has heard on that subject, or at least something familiar but in a different way, you've also got this underlying fear that people are going to hear the verses and they're just going to switch off because they know what you're going to say already. Or the points from a story, they pretty much present themselves, so why don't we just read the verses and save ourselves some time? To those people, I can't promise you that I've found hidden meaning in a familiar story which has laid unrevealed for the last 2,000 years. But I have found a lot of things I hadn't really considered before, and I've been uncomfortably challenged on a personal level by some of that. My aim today, as it always is when I come to speak, is to leave you challenged but hopeful. That's kind of like my mission statement for speaking. That's what I want to do. So as we read these verses from Mark chapter 4, which have got so much to tell us about who Jesus is, who we are, and how we can and should handle difficult times in life, don't let familiarity rob you of a chance to hear something from God for you in the midst of what I believe he's challenged me to bring today. Okay, so we're starting from verse 35. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along, just as he was, in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." First of all, this morning, I'm just going to speak quickly through the verses, just to pick out a few points of interest, things that may not necessarily be immediately obvious or jumped out at me in some way. And literally the first few words in verse 35, it says, "That day when evening came." Jesus has literally just been preaching parables about the kingdom. We've heard recently the parable of the sower, and just before you get to verse 35, Jesus has told the story of the kingdom of God being like a mustard seed, growing from the smallest of seeds into something much bigger than you would ever believe possible. He tells story after story to the crowd, and then he explains the meaning to the disciples privately afterwards, until the point where their heads are probably just stuffed full of teaching. And then what follows, what we've just read, really does follow straight on from that. Jesus calls them to action after he's finished talking. It's like, right, that's enough chat. Let's go over to the other side of the lake. Except, of course, that it's evening. I'm not sure that bit had ever registered before. When I read, I kind of picture things in my mind's eye. And whenever I've read it before, I always imagine it being daytime. Because, you know, who gets into a boat at nighttime? What's the urgency? The Sea of Galilee is really, really unpredictable. It's set really way below sea level. I mean, it's basically surrounded by hills and mountains. And this mixture of air pressures means things can whip up really, really quickly. And it's also quite shallow. So if you do get a storm, it doesn't take much for the whole lake to basically just get really active and for a storm to basically have a much bigger effect than it would have if the sea was a lot deeper. So, given that fact, and given the fact that even in daylight things can change quickly, at night you've got no chance whatsoever of reading the signs of an impending storm. So this strange decision is compounded by what we read in that there's no real preparation for the trip. The disciples, instead of questioning the wisdom of such a decision, or maybe even just getting a few bits together at least, they just take Jesus along, just as he was, and they just got in the boat. They wandered over to the boat at night and got in to cross the lake because Jesus said, "Let's go over to the other side." I'm not really sure why, but every time I've been reading it, I've just thought of the joke of why did the chicken cross the road to get to the other side? You know, it seems like there's no reason for it, and it just keeps kind of going back, but there we go. And lo and behold, out of nowhere, up comes a storm. And what a shock, the disciples are woefully underprepared for that. Their small fishing vessel is quickly in danger of being swamped, of genuinely sinking. Again, sorry, I keep mentioning it, but in the dark, they're in the dark. I don't know what they're doing. For me, I'm not a particularly strong swimmer, you see. So, and for this to be in an era when life jackets hadn't been invented, you know, it wasn't even a twinkle in the eye of a great-great-great-great-grandparent, whoever did invent life jackets. This is nightmare territory stuff for me. And just to highlight how serious this was, this story appears in three of the Gospels, and in Matthew's version of the story, he uses the word seismos for storm. I think you can probably even guess what that means when you talk about earthquakes, basically. The other 10 places that word's used, it's used to describe an earthquake. This is a big storm. So here they are in the eye of this storm at night, where they're going to lose all sense of direction immediately. So no idea of which direction safety is, no idea how far away safety is. It's like this, just being surrounded by this bubble of terror that they can't escape from. They're completely helpless in that moment. It's all they can do just to keep the boat afloat. And even that could be gone at any time. They are in a total state of panic. And suddenly remember, have any of you seen Jesus recently? How is Jesus still asleep? I mean, how quickly could this storm have come up that he could still be asleep at the point where they actually remember that he's still on the boat somewhere? And he gets up. And he says, I mean, in English we get three words, but it's two words. He says, silence, be still. And the first, I think of as more of a kind of shh, quiet. The kind of, it really reminded me of kind of dog training, or like, you know, where you're, you know, authoritative, directive, you know, that kind of silence. And that was really funny, because when I looked at what the second word meant, the second word for be still actually quite literally means to muzzle. So it really did remind me of that at that point. Is it any wonder the disciples end up in genuine fear of Jesus? Basically, this is a man who talks to a storm like people talk to a dog, and he gets better results. And as quickly as the storm came, it goes, and it becomes extraordinarily, perfectly calm. The wind fell like Jesus had just flicked the off switch, and it became amazingly peaceful on the lake. And he turns to his disciples. And again, it may be me reading a bit. There's definitely a tone of exasperation here. Why are you afraid? It's almost a, have you not been listening to a word I've said all day? Or, look guys, if there was anything to be worried about, do you think I wouldn't have at least woken up? And the story, as I said just before, it appears in three of the Gospels. It's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the next statement that we get here about the disciples having no faith, it says it slightly differently in each one. In what we've read in Mark, it says, Jesus says to them, do you still have no faith? In Matthew's gospel, he says to them, you of little faith, why are you so afraid? And in Luke, Jesus says, where is your faith? And maybe the truth that kind of pulls together the three is this picture of disciples with a very tiny faith, which quickly deserts them and amounts to nothing once they're in the eye of a storm. But I think Jesus is saying to them, I thought you knew better than this. I was right here with you. Was that really not enough to sustain that little bit of faith that you have? And then the fear that the disciples have of the storm quickly switches to a fear of the one who can tell the storm to just shut up, basically. And that provokes in them a question, which is a very relevant question for each one of us, of who is this that can do things like that? How well do I really know him? The disciples were with him day after day, hearing his teaching and having his kind of private lessons and explaining the parables after the event. And Jesus tells them they should have known better. But when events transpired, when it came down to it, they panicked and they didn't think straight. They didn't have that right thinking, but if there's someone that you lean on in a storm, it should be Jesus, despite everything they'd seen, everything they'd heard, and despite him being present on the boat with them at the time. And that lack of understanding and appreciation of who Jesus was for them at that point held back their faith from being all that it could be. What do you do with that eye-opener as one of those disciples? That's going to hurt in that moment, that realization of what you've done. So that's the story, where a number of Jesus' disciples are given some uncomfortable home truths about where their faith was lacking, and an opportunity to reflect on who they were as people, but much more importantly, who this Jesus person was that they'd been following around, and the things that he could do. It's an amazing passage, not least because in 7 short verses, we get a very interesting picture of a movement from conversion to discipleship, and it may be something that's a familiar picture to some of us as to how a relationship with Jesus might look at times. It's in 7 verses. Jesus calls. You follow him, leaving the crowd behind. You get in the boat and take him with you, just as you are, just as he is. There are other boats with you. A storm will come. At times, you'll wonder if your boat will survive. Jesus will be with you, but you may not initially turn to him. A point will come where you will turn to him in his seeming inactivity, and you'll say, do you even care? He'll bring peace. Where's your faith? He'll say. We'll feel shame, and hopefully we'll remember to be in awe of God a little more next time, and a little less in awe of the world as a result. There were loads and loads of really great quotes I found, but there were a couple which I found really helpful in the context of the passage. And the first of these was, how well a disciple knows Jesus affects how they will handle the testing of their faith. So how well someone knows Jesus affects how they'll handle those times of testing. And the second one was, you will know as much of God and only as much of God as you're willing to put into practice. And one of the necessities with those things in mind is the need for a strong faith because of the inevitability of times of testing, and that these times will sort through those who truly have faith and those who like the ideas and to whom Jesus maybe appeals on some level but who have not truly engaged with Jesus. And if we're to have any chance of letting doubts, fears, worries, or concerns not completely drown out our faith, then we really need to understand who Jesus is and get into a mindset of knowing he really is present with us in everything. And I do feel I need to say that doesn't mean that Jesus will just fix everything. He won't always take the storm away. It doesn't mean that time of testing will just end at the point where we call out to Jesus. But in one sense or another, he will bring peace in every circumstance if we come to him. And we need to understand that he wants us to do just that. And either calm the storm, which he does sometimes, or just be present while you ride out the storm together. For a little while, around a decade ago, there was a very popular book called If You Want to Walk on Water, You've Got to Get Out of the Boat. You probably remember it. I was in his house group when we looked at it and did some books and some videos as well, if I remember rightly. I think it was a bit of a mixture of that. But it was it just kind of goes to show how confusing Christian teaching can be at times, because the passage we've read seems to suggest the opposite. And if you want to get anywhere with God, you've got to get into the boat with him. You know, get in the boat, get out of the boat. You know, it can be very confusing at times. And I've already fallen into this trap already, but it's really difficult not to kind of just allegorize every part of a story. I could ask questions like, is Jesus in the boat with you now? How many times does it feel like you're in a storm and Jesus is asleep? What boats are you in at this time in your life? Or what storms are going on in your life right now? And there's nothing wrong with any of that. None of those questions aren't fair from a text, or, you know, none of them aren't questions that you shouldn't helpfully ask yourself from time to time. But maybe this story is just about a boat. And in this context, a means of Jesus and his disciples moving from one place and going to another place. And that's it. What could we take from that? Well, I think it's probably fair to say that for most people, most of the time, left to our own devices, we're pretty happy keeping things exactly as they are. I mentioned earlier, the disciples could very reasonably have said to Jesus, do we really need to go now? What's the rush? Why are we even going over there? Do we need to go over there at all? What's wrong with here? We've got some really interesting stuff going on this side of the shore. I don't really know why you want to go over there, but I'm actually quite happy here, so let's just stay here, or at least have a good sleep, and then go in the morning when we can see what the weather's like. No, no. He provides an invitation and says, let us go over to the other side. Let us move on from here, from where you're used to, and move on to another place. Maybe not a better place. Maybe not an easier place. And certainly a less comfortable place, with it being a move into the unknown. But moving ahead with Jesus. But we seem to miss the invitation that Jesus makes to us. And we wait at times. Wait for what? The right time? An easier time? Are we waiting for God to write a detailed message on your front lawn when you wake up one morning? I mean, I joke, but that would actually be fantastic. If, you know, that would be great. I'm sure any of us would appreciate that. Maybe you're waiting for a call, waiting to hear from God, as if the call hasn't been made clear already. In Matthew 28, the Great Commission to go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. You know, was that only relevant to a group of people in the past? Or is it okay? It's relevant for people now, but maybe people who are more suited to that task today. It's not for everyone, it's for the people who'd be good at it. And really, I'm not sure I'm one of those people. What call are we waiting for that isn't specific and clear enough an instruction to get us into the boat and heading wherever it is Jesus wants to take you right now? And this is the problem with Jesus. Yeah, as if there's one problem. What we see in the way that he relates to the disciples is that he likes to keep things moving. Time is of the essence. He's got so much to teach them, so much to show them, to get them ready for when he's gone. He doesn't have the time to let them stay in one place for too long, either physically or spiritually. And our problem, so often, is what we think we've got time, or there's enough time. But I don't know if I really want to sit around waiting for something for the rest of my life, only to know that I've got to stand in front of God one day and to say to him, well, you never called me. You never told me what it was that you wanted me to do. Only for him to say, well, what did you think this was? Suggested reading? I think you maybe seem to think it was some kind of dust collection device. If there's any frustration, it's all aimed at me, by the way. We read this story and we believe that the act of faith is to trust Jesus to calm a storm. And it is. It definitely is. But maybe it's also taking the invitation to heart and on this day, right now, getting into the boat. Maybe it's believing that another side, another shore, is not only possible for you, but it's essential. Because that's discipleship. It's a journey. And if there's one thing a journey can't be, it's static. Its definition demands movement. And true discipleship demands movement. God invites us to move on to another place with him. Part of this story that we need to take away is that there is something on the other side that we may not know about, but Jesus knows about, and he needs to get us over there. And it's very interesting about we already mentioned about the song choices today, but there was a phrase that niggled at me while I was writing this. I knew it was from a song, and I quickly remembered it was from Love Divine, or Love's Excelling. So when I read the order of service last night, I knew it would be on there before I opened it. I knew it would be on there, and I actually would have been surprised if it hadn't. So it was just, but it was nice to get that confirmation at the same time. But it was this phrase of being changed from glory into glory. Into glory would always be something we would tend to talk about in terms of going to heaven. We talk about people going to glory. But I'm just going to read this last verse to you, as I found it really helpful. Finish then thy new creation, pure and sinless let us be. Let us see thy great salvation perfectly restored in thee. Change from glory into glory, till in heaven we take our place, till we cast our crowns before thee, lost in wonder, love, and praise. I found really, I was really encouraged by the fact that I realized that when we talk about being a new creation as a Christian, can I just say, a new creation was not finished at the point that we believed in God.